It has been almost 12 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. That number sometimes causes a double take. No, the February 2022 invasion of Ukraine wasn't 12 years ago. That part of the war is coming up on its fourth anniversary. 12 years ago, Russia flooded Crimea with unmarked troops, little green men, or polite people, depending on whose euphemisms you're using, and engineered a referendum of sorts ahead of annexing the peninsula. Illegally annexing the peninsula, many people point out. As that unfolded in Crimea, Moscow aided in more ways than one other groups of men in eastern Ukraine seeking to challenge the revolutionaries who just triumphed against the national government in Kyiv. Of course, I'm talking about Euromaidan and its so-called antithesis, the anti-Maidan, or Russian Spring. And their confrontation comes under close scrutiny in new research by American scholar William J. Riesch, a professor of Russian and Eastern European history at Georgia College here in the United States. Next month, Bloomsbury Academic is releasing his next book, Ukraine's Euromaidan: From Revolutionary Euphoria to the Madness of War, where he writes a critical survey of the 2013 to 2014 Euromaidan revolution and the anti-Maidan counter-protest movement. Riesch's assessment of these movements and these events isn't what you would typically read in Western writing. He focuses on the marginalization of leftist voices during Euromaidan as it gained international appeal, and on how activists and politicians failed to secure concessions or mobilize broader segments of the Ukrainian population. Riesch also describes the agency and aspirations that drove the counter-protests of the so-called Russian Spring, explaining how escalating revolutionary violence weakened Ukrainian unity and contributed to where the country finds itself today. So let's talk to William Riesch about his new book, Ukraine's Euromaidan: From Revolutionary Euphoria to the Madness of War. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, the managing editor of Medusa in English. Sometimes I make this part into a little musical promotion thing, but this time I'll just say straight out that I write a daily newsletter for Medusa. With each message, I focus on a single story involving Russia that catches my interest. It could be a new investigation, some interesting essay or op-ed, a feature that we didn't manage to translate for Medusa. It's whatever I fancy. Visit our website and sign up. I would love to have your subscription. Okay, so today's interview is a little bit longer than usual. I clocked it at about 40 minutes, and that's before I added this introduction that you just heard. So I'd like to jump right in with my conversation with Bill without teasing you any further. Just a quick note, you can check the show notes of this episode for a hyperlink to Bloomsbury's website to order a copy of the book. At the time I am recording this, it's available for pre-order, and shipping begins on February 19th, and that's this year, 2026, my goodness. First question, you were personally involved in Euromaidan. You talk about, you know, being there in Kyiv, spreading literature against the Yanukovych regime, if I'm in the subway, right?
Right. It happened.
It happened.
It's hard to believe now that, you know, there have been literally almost 12 years have passed since that happened.
So you mentioned this in the book, you describe it, but then you also write in the book, and this is sort of maybe the larger argument in the book, you write about the revolution with sort of disillusionment. I mean, that's kind of the word I would use to describe what I read in the book. Was there a moment in all these events and all this drama when your feelings about Euromaidan changed, or was it a gradual process?
I would say it was a very gradual process, because at least when the protests were nonviolent through January 2014, it seemed like there was a chance for a grassroots effort that would maybe be even better than such other protests as Occupy Wall Street, that it would actually change a political system for Ukraine from the ground up. And there were people who talked about this, that this would be a revolution that would change the entire system. There was a point where it wasn't just about joining Europe, the European Union. By December, it did look like there were people determined to change everything, the entire system from the ground up. And there were such voices that were there calling for a systematic change to allow for not just a change of regime, but to change institutions, to replace elites peacefully, to put pressure on the government to make concessions. But I would say that the February uprising just sort of left this sense of devastation, really. When those shootings happened on the Maidan, February the 20th, on Institutska Street, it just seemed like everything started to go. I mean, at the time, there was this sense of great mourning because these people lost their lives, and this sense that, well, what did they lose their lives for? And the problem was, as we went through the spring of 2014, there were other voices that were speaking out and saying that this was a coup, this new regime is illegitimate. And while at a certain point, perhaps it was clear by April 2014 that there were armed men, activists from Russia stirring this up, there were local elites stirring this up, and events started to spin out of control. And soon we see Russia fully involved in the Donbass by the summer of 2014, definitely July and August. Then it was clear that this revolution is in trouble. I would say by the fall of 2014, maybe I still had hope because there were elections, parliamentary elections, and there were Maidan activists who were elected as members of parliament, such as Mustafa Nayom, who is credited with starting this whole thing. But everything just started to take this turn that suggested that, well, a regime was replaced by another, and the same elites were still there. And nothing had really changed except there was a war with Russia that distracted everyone and pretty much occupied the public space, the media space, really from, I would say, the summer of 2014 on. And those chances to perhaps change the system were gone.
So I think listeners might be a little confused to hear some of what you just said. I mean, it's certainly like it's a detour from what is typically heard in like mainstream Anglophone reporting, but especially the notion that the revolution, that the Euromaidan movement failed, given that Ukraine is now on a Euro integration path, at least to the degree that the war is, you know, not preventing that. But it seems as though the movement succeeded in ousting the regime that was blocking this initiative that the movement was in favor of. Do you think that, I mean, your involvement in it sounds as though it was not all about Euro integration, and that you got involved for other reasons. You mentioned leftists, and do you think that the movement as a whole was actually not just about European integration, or was that not the main goal of the movement? Because this seems important to just determining how successful it was.
If I go back to what I observed, it seemed like European integration, yes, was very important. But European integration to serve certain ends, namely to bring about rule of law, to create greater opportunities for business, for the creation of jobs at home, the idea of making government accountable to the people was very important. I think of what I mentioned in the book about Kharkiv after the revolution allegedly had won. And there were local activists on television at the end of February 2014. And one of them mentioned the need to have the Maidan continue to exist as a sort of people's assembly of Vecha in Ukrainian or Vyecha in Russian that would hold government to account locally, that would have to approve government appointments at the local level, and would force pressure on the government to prosecute the mayor of Kharkiv, who had been involved in all of these criminal acts allegedly against Euromaidan activists and other figures. And all of that just, you know, nothing came of it. The next day or so was March the 1st, 2014, and there was this huge anti-Maidan rally that got out of control, seized control of the building where the Euromaidan activists had set up camp at one point, and chased them out violently and decorated the building with Russian flags at one point.
But at other points in the book, you suggest that, or you argue that the anarchy unleashed by the the revolutionaries is one of the key reasons that chases the Eastern, you know, future People's Republics into Russia's arms. But what you just described to me sounds like a form of unelected governance, which I would imagine sort of ordinary law-abiding citizen would not necessarily be thrilled that there's some self-appointed collective trying to, you know, overturn appointments out of some building in Kharkiv. So it seems as though, like, are you having it both ways here? I mean, do you see the issue I'm having?
Well, I mean, there were activists on the Euromaidan side who were trying to put pressure on the government to reform itself locally. There were activists trying to change the system, but they were also identified with by other Kharkiv residents as a power that was potentially going to terrorize Kharkiv residents with far-right elements involved. Around the time that this happened in Kharkiv, in eastern Ukraine, where the Maidan triumphed, supposedly, and your Maidan activists were going to finally provide for a better government, a better system in Kharkiv. They're going to fight for that peacefully. That very same day, there was a far-right group known as Patriot of Ukraine, and they chased out the pro-Russian paramilitary organization known as Bulwark or Oplot in Russian. They chased them out and took over their fight club and made it their headquarters. And there were these far-right elements, opponents of the Maidan in Kharkiv. They exploited those elements and said, look, the far-right is trying to take power in Kharkiv. We got to do something. And that led to these thousands of people showing up there in Kharkiv to take back the regional state administration building in Kharkiv, where some activists had gone. Euromaidan activists had gone and set up, well, really, their new headquarters on the first floor of the building. So these were people who, I mean, these were Euromaidan activists who were hoping to change government for the better, but the local elites at the time were using the violence that happened in February 2014 to get people to fight back against the Euromaidan. I don't know if this helps to answer your question, but the thing is, you do have these different groups spurred on by local elites and by the media that really threatened the unity of the country.
Well, let me ask you a question about identity politics. It's a term that you use at different points in the book, and you use it to describe both the Euromaidan faction and the anti-Maidan faction, or at least the Donbass, at least, not necessarily the anti-Maidan. But you write that the Euromaidan, they're drawn into this nationalist rhetoric that speaks more to identity politics than changing a political system. You've been talking a bit about the sort of failure to change the political system, and that these identity politics are basically exclusionary, that this essentially is what leads to further divisions and problems for Ukraine society, that it's ultimately, you describe it as kind of arrogant at times. It delegitimizes the interests of the Donbass, specifically when it comes to sort of their class and cultural interests. And then when you're talking about the Donbass and the Party of Regions sponsored media and the local politicians, you say that they channel ordinary people's frustrations with the emerging post-Soviet order, corruption, misrule, deindustrialization, unemployment, and you describe this as a toxic local identity politics. And so I wonder, those things right there, or at least the deindustrialization and unemployment, that to me sounds more like class politics than identity politics. So I wonder, could you explain for me, like, is Euromaidan using identity politics and anti-Maidan is using class politics, or are they both using identity politics? And how exactly does this work out in your vision?
Well, I do agree that class politics become very important in this anti-Maidan movement and what happens after the Maidan comes to power in Kyiv. If you look at what goes on in the East, particularly in the Donbass, there are these class grievances, but the class grievances become channeled into identity politics. In some ways, one could maybe see that as comparable to what goes on in the Euromaidan, because there are people who see that the best solution to the social inequality and the corruption in government is to unite the nation and to bring about a national spirit that is more oriented toward Europe and which is supposedly more inclusive. But when you look at the identity politics that go on at the Euromaidan, and if you look at its predecessor, the Orange Revolution that happened in Ukraine in 2004, there is a national identity There is a national ideology that does treat certain people and movements as heroes in Ukraine, and which relates to Russia in a way that can be contested. Because if you look at before independence, there was Soviet Ukraine. There were Ukrainians who saw themselves as Soviet Ukrainians. And for them, yes, it was important to have self-rule for Soviet Ukraine, and it was important to have independence, but they didn't want to split completely with Russia. So there are identity politics there in the Euromaidan, national identity politics, which could potentially alienate people in the East, and which did. The embracing of certain national heroes, such as Stepan Bandera and the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. The problem is that these are heroes with very complicated pasts, because in many ways they are heroes to participants of the Euromaidan, because Stepan Bandera was a victim of Soviet special services who murdered him. The OUN, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, and the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, the UPA, they fought Soviet rule. They did. Many were killed and tortured by Soviet special forces. The problem is we do know that they have a very complicated past, because during World War II, they collaborated with Nazi Germany, and to some extent, they were complicit in the Holocaust and in the murder of ethnic Poles in Western Ukraine. That part, I tried to sort of keep a very brief focus on that, because I know that it becomes very complicated for the book, but this is where the exclusion comes from. When you have a movement that would prefer that people speak in Ukrainian as well as Russian, when you have a movement that is definitely opposed to Russian dominance, this will pose a problem for people who want to have friendly, brotherly relations with Russia. And the anti-Maidan promoted friendly, brotherly relations with Russia, not necessarily submitting to everything that Russia wants, but definitely getting along with Russia. And that was a real concern. When I tried to speak to people in the Donbass and Donetsk, there were people who said, look, we've got to get along with Russia, and it doesn't mean that we want to become slaves to Russia. You have to understand that we do have these special relations with Russia and with the rest of Ukraine, and that the Donbass is in an in-between position. The problem is, when all this violence does happen in February 2014, it does radicalize people on both sides of the barricades. And everybody forgot about that. That's why my book goes all the way until May the 2nd in Odessa, with the what some call the Odessa tragedy or the Odessa massacre, where violence between Euromaidan forces, which at this point in time, May the 2nd, 2014, are seen as the forces of pro-Ukrainian unity in Odessa and other parts of Ukraine, they fight with these anti-Maidan forces that become identified with pro-Russian forces, but also Donbass separatists. That tragedy sort of signals the end to the Maidan, I would say, even though it does linger physically as a space until August 2014, and in many ways becomes really an object of disgrace and ridicule. It's very sad how that square just sort of empties out and becomes something that, well, looks rather hideous. People move on.
The book has, as you've been describing, the book has a lot of detail about sort of the various skirmishes that happen throughout the Euromaidan movement as it culminates in Kyiv, and then as it sort of leads to clashes in other cities, especially, where there's this massacre or tragedy, depending on your perspective, in Odessa. One of the big overarching arguments of the book is that Euromaidan's essentially right-wing or nationalist turn toward uncivility, toward violence, it precludes a peaceful resolution of Ukraine's political crisis. That's the term that you use. You say that that collective decisions to wage war against the state instead of resisting peacefully were a choice. You're saying that the choices were made that precluded a peaceful resolution. One of the questions I had reading this was, given what happened outside Luhansk and Donetsk and Crimea, where Russia, brought more force to bear, it seems like Euromaidan succeeded, or at least in defeating anti-Maidan through violence, admittedly. But is it fair to say that maybe they precluded a peaceful resolution, but if it weren't for Russian intervention, they would have secured a violent resolution? Or do you think that it would have continued to spiral? Because this is one of the central questions of the book, I think, is, and I know that you don't set out to lay blame, and you clearly have a sort of aversion to some of the more moralizing narratives about Ukraine. You call out Marcy Shore a few times, but
right.
It does seem as though a lot of the sort of vector of the book is, if not about moral blame, then at least sort of arguing that such and such choices led to such and such results. Is it possible to say, or is it fair to say, that Euromaidan would have won the day through violence if it weren't for Russian intervention, or is that the wrong takeaway?
Well, it does raise a very good question, Kevin. What if Russia had not intervened? There seems to be the consensus, at least from those who supported the Euromaidan or Ukrainian unity in places like Donetsk, that Ukrainians would have been able to sort their problems out together. And there is a lot to be said for that, because these acts of vigilante violence that happened around the time of the February uprising in Kyiv and which spread to the provinces, they did burn out rather quickly, and people tried to get along.
And if I'm not mistaken, after the Odessa fire, you talk about, it's in Kharkiv where the dueling factions essentially look at what's happened and say, well, hold on, this is getting out of hand, or am I misremembering a section of the book?
Well, it's actually Mykolaiv in the south,
yes,
where
okay.
Both sides come together
okay.
And decide we're going to reconcile our difference.
So that seems like kind of a hopeful sign.
It is a hopeful sign.
Okay.
But I mean, to be honest, the problem is that anybody that opposed the Maidan, they risk the possibility of being accused of being pro-Russian elements and fifth columnists. So the critics of the Maidan basically have to go silent by the time of the Odessa massacre or tragedy. And while there are efforts to reconcile, and they do happen in places like Mykolaiv, like in Zaporizhia, I mean, they just disappear. The SBU is looking for them. In Kharkiv, the SBU is looking for them. And local elites are on the side of Kyiv. They make deals with Kyiv, and they support Ukrainian unity throughout Ukraine, south and east, minus the republic set up in the Donbass, the so-called republics, minus what's happened in Crimea. Crimea is absorbed into Russia, annexed.
That is a resolution, though, isn't it?
There is a resolution. There is a resolution.
Okay.
That is true.
Okay.
But then those people who didn't like what was going on over there in Kyiv, they just sort of have to live with it, it seems to me. And the other problem, too, is you have to bring this into consideration, is the threat from Russia overshadows everything. So people cannot really air their differences anymore openly, because there is this threat that everyone faces from Russia. So it's important not to take the separatist path.
Does Euromaidan become as violent if you don't have the Russian threat looming, if you don't have Putin using this like frightening rhetoric? And certainly like the specter of Russian intervention is hanging overhead, and I would imagine that radicalizes the Euromaidan people, right? It would presumably...
It does radicalize the Euromaidan people, but I want to make this clear also that the book also sees the violence generated by pro-Russian elements encouraged by Russia. That violence in Kharkiv, March the 1st, 2014. That violence in Luhansk, March the 9th.
The bus.
That violence in Donetsk, by March the 13th, 2014, that scares everybody that had supported the Euromaidan. That scares everybody that supported Ukraine unity. And that leads to people in the South taking action. Maybe it wasn't rational to some degree. Was Russia really going to take Odessa? But everybody was convinced they were coming for Odessa. Everybody was convinced they're coming for Mykolaiv and Zaporizhia and Kherson. So we got to be on the lookout. We need to look for fifth columnists. We need to stop these pro-Russian elements. And so instead of any sort of debates over, well, should Ukraine become a federal state? Well, should Ukraine be non-aligned? Those arguments sort of fall by the wayside because the nation is under threat.
Do you feel as though, or do you know, during the Euromaidan movement, as this is unfolding in Kyiv, in the Donbass, you know, you write in your book that the sight of all this anarchy is frightening for people that are living in the East, and they're essentially afraid of European integration because they have their own sort of class interests, I guess. Can you speak a little bit about this? Because I think this is another subject that a lot of listeners probably are not necessarily aware of. All they know is, well, you know, Russia has its tendrils in the East and through propaganda. And you do talk about, you know, the media diets of both the Maidan activists and the Donbass residents. You talk about how they both sort of lose trust in mainstream media and retreat into sort of online echo chambers, and that this is another sort of radicalizing phenomenon, I suppose. But for somebody who's unfamiliar with the perspective of somebody living in the Donbass during the Maidan movement, before any opolchensi or whatever show up, could you describe what someone should assume is happening in their heads?
Well, I think what seems to be happening, and I try to do my best as a historian, as an analyst, to understand this, is that in general, there was this crisis of legitimacy in Ukraine, an entire political class that did not speak for the people, regardless of what region they belonged to. And the thing is that for the Maidan activists, the Euromaidan activists, that system had become illegitimate. Yanukovych's regime had become illegitimate. Yanukovych had to go. The regime had to be changed. The political system had to change. In the East, there was a similar disgust with elites and the level of corruption that they had engaged in.
Even though technically their party is in power? Is that right?
Right. Even though their party was in power. You do see where there's no real enthusiasm for the Party of Regions in 2012 and 2013. But there is fears about the so-called Orange Plague. So they're stuck with this choice of the so-called Orange Plague or what? The system that doesn't work for them either. And so you do have at least radical elements who are saying, look, we've got to, maybe Russia's the way out. But that is, admittedly, is getting to the point where you have the self-defense people with guns, the opolchensi and so on. But it would seem to me that in 2013, January 2014, February 2014, the most important thing is that for these people in the Donbass, yes, this system was unjust, unfair, and corrupt, but they did not see an alternative. The alternative was not there at the Maidan. The Maidan consisted of, again, this goes to perhaps perceptions and what the media was conveying at the time. But the media at the time was conveying, and social media was probably conveying this as well, that it's being led by the same old faces that stole from Ukraine before, these political opposition leaders who were leading the Maidan, and that these people were not ones they're going to follow. And the activists, and then this is the problem here, you get the far right, okay? By the time we get to 2013, 2014, we do have a small political party, the Svoboda Party, the Freedom Party, as I call it in English in the book. They only get 10% of the vote, but they become a major part of the opposition coalition, the opposition to Yanukovych's Party of Regions in Parliament. And they are involved in a lot of the violence against the state. They're the most uncompromising of the political parties when it comes to Yanukovych. And Svoboda's leaders, the Freedom Party's leaders, they capitalize on that. The problem is that when they get involved in radicalizing the protests, and this happens first, to some degree you see it in the last week of November 2014 in Kyiv, when the initial protests begin. But then you really see it on December the 1st, when the protesters who have been driven off the square the night of November 29 to 30, they take the square back with hundreds of thousands of people and opposition politicians. These Freedom Party activists and others from the far right, they seize control of administrative buildings to some extent. They take over Kyiv City Hall. They bust their way into the trade unions building on the main square, the Maidan. And some of them try and attack the presidential administration building. And those people, Freedom Party, but others, Patriot of Ukraine and so on, they sort of become the face of this protest movement in the media. And that terrifies people in the Donbass, and Donbass politicians exploit this. They talk about how all this violence is happening. There were local politicians in Kharkiv, local activists in Kharkiv who would be considered maybe pro-Yanukovych in Kharkiv and in Donetsk, for sure, who were outraged by the violent crackdown on the Euromaidan the night of November 29 to 30, 2013. But they were equally appalled by the violence of December the 1st and blamed it on far-right parties who had taken power in the parliament, well, who had taken a niche in the opposition and who are influencing politics in parliament. That these far-right types were going to lead Ukraine into chaos. And so this did alienate people in the Donbass region, where already they'd been more or less set up to assume that these political parties that are at the Maidan are far-right fascists and so on. And, you know, this is part of a very long-term historical trend here, at least since 1991, where those parties that were at the heart of Ukraine's Orange Revolution were seen as in cahoots with far-right forces and the United States and so on. And these myths had been spreading for some time. And in the Donbass, they become part of this machine of hate that's generating all this hysteria. And, you know, when they finally do take power, the far-right supposedly takes power in February 2014, these people are terrified because the media, local elites, whispering propaganda spreads this idea that, my God, right sector, one of these far-right forces that were there at the Maidan during its radical phase, that right sector is going to come over to Donetsk and kill us and all this stuff. And these rumors, they spread and people believe them. Because as you mentioned, Kevin, there is this distrust, not just in the political class, but in the media. The state media lies. And for the Maidan people, the state media lied against the Maidan systematically. And so they're going to their alternative sources, to social media. And, you know, this is why social media becomes so important as an alternative source of information. And online channels such as Promazka TV, Citizens TV, they become very important. And other minor channels, too, in broadcasting the news and providing an alternative source of information for the Euromaidan protesters. Well, what happens when all this collapses, the Yanukovych regime collapses and everything? What happens with the Donbass people? They turn to their alternative sources of information. And that leads to them supporting, or at least tacitly supporting, more radical actions that lead to pro-Russian forces in cahoots with Russia taking power eventually.
Do you view what's happened in the Donbass as, I mean, obviously it's tragic no matter what your position is, whether you're like someone's like a bona fide, like, you know, Z patriot or a Euromaidan right sector activist, doesn't matter. It's a tragedy with so many deaths. But in terms of the ordinary people who are the activists in Euromaidan, the activists in anti-Maidan, although in your book you do document all kinds of, like, you know, paid demonstrators and, you know, Russian tourists and so on. It wasn't clear to me how much of a euphemism that is, but yeah, you know, visiting Russian nationals and so on. So not to equate the grassroots merits of the sides, but certainly there are ordinary people that are caught up in all this. Obviously, the war is a tragedy for everyone. I guess, like, I'm interested to hear more about how the Donbass elites and your reading of this history, how it is they navigate the Maidan Revolution and what it means for ordinary people living in eastern Ukraine. And let's say before the full-scale Russian invasion, because obviously it's been a nightmare for the whole country since that began. But you've mentioned that they exploited the situation. They played on, you know, fears and so on. Maybe you've already sort of answered this, but can you walk me through it one more time, just kind of how this plays out?
Well, it's very important, Kevin, to understand that the Party of Regions factions, the groupings between Party of Regions politicians and business in the Donetsk region, the Luhansk region, to varying extents, they were trying to build their own political enclaves that would ensure them support, immunity from criminal prosecution, and so on. And these elites, they had to do something to defend themselves against this political earthquake happening in Kyiv. They were already concerned about this in December 2013, urging Yanukovych to take further action against the protesters. They were very concerned about this in January and become quite alarmist as the protests become violent, first at Hrushevsky Street, the street that leads up to Parliament, where violence breaks out on January the 19th, 2014. And when there are regional uprisings in central and western Ukraine that follow on the week of, like, it was January the 20th to the 27th, sweeping through those provinces. They were afraid that this was going to happen to them. So yes, they do exploit people's fears of a far-right coup coming to power. And these are people with business interests in Russia, ties with Russia, political, informal ties with Russia, who want to maintain those ties too. And they exploit the pro-Russian sentiments as much as they can, the anti-Maidan sentiments, I really should say. Not really pro-Russian, but anti-Maidan, anti-Kyiv sentiments. They're there. I try and argue in the book that if you look at after the Maidan takes power, February 2014, you have these people who are afraid of what Kyiv is going to do to them. And so you do see the local elites, just like in the Orange Revolution of 2004, supporting pro-Russian demonstrators, protest groups, also paramilitaries, supporting them and encourage them to speak out.
Can I ask a quick clarification? When you talk about the fears of a another orange sort of revolution in Kyiv and how that manifests in eastern Ukraine, what does that mean in practice? Is it like, oh, they're going to pass economic reforms that cost us all our jobs, or the trade agreement with the EU is going to cost us all our jobs? Or is it they're going to send, you know, groups of armed, you know, neo-Nazis into town and string us all up? Like, what's the level of fear? How does it, if you were to stop somebody or if you were to read the local media and try to ascertain what are they actually afraid of? Like, what would you find?
I would say that you're right on both counts. There were fears, genuine fears about the economic consequences of all this. What would happen to people's jobs in the East with moving closer to the EU? Wouldn't they lose Russian markets? Wouldn't industries close down? And there were rumors spreading about coal mines being shut down and so on, and people becoming slave laborers to Europe. But also there was that fear of the violence, that there really would be people from right sectors, such as the infamous Sashko Bili from Western Ukraine, the city of Rivne, who brandished this rifle and this pistol in front of local officials at some meeting that was on YouTube, that these kinds of people would come over to them and take over and terrorize. So that was there too. But also, you know, this idea that they would knock down Lenin monuments and Soviet monuments. We forgot to talk about that element. The Euromaidan, as it radicalizes in January and February, leads to the toppling of Lenin monuments. Actually, it was started in December 2013 in Kyiv, and then it spreads. And when we get to the regime falling in late February 22, this is where we see all these Lenin monuments being toppled, including in the East and in the South, in places, particularly in the South, in places like Mykolaiv and in Kherson.
And the notion here is that it's offensive, but it's also creates a physical space where the two groups can meet and fight over something.
That is true. And that's what happens. Fights break out or threaten to break out where the Lenin monuments are. There's this sense that our history is under assault and that it won't be just about Lenin, but also the World War II monuments. And also, you know, the language issue shows up because, well, there had been this attempt by the parliament in Ukraine on February the 23rd to repeal a language law that allowed for Russian to become basically the state language of regional governments in Ukraine's east and south. And that repeal was vetoed by the acting president, Oleksandr Turchynov, but still that was exploited by the opponents of the Maidan, who were in the political class in eastern and southern Ukraine. It was exploited by pro-Russian activists who said, look, they're going to take our language too. They're going to make us all speak Ukrainian, and they're going to shoot Russian speakers. I mean, those kinds of rumors were there too. It's pretty wild, I mean, what was going on. I just think that people just did not know what was going to happen next. And this hysteria, I mean, that's what happens when you overthrow a regime through force. It's going to cause these problems. And that's why I wrote this book, because it just seemed like, well, here's February the 21st, February the 22nd. We mourn the loss of all those people killed on the Maidan, which is horrible. And then we just sort of say, oh, the Maidan won and Ukraine is now with Europe. And then that's it. I had to go all the way until May the 2nd, 2014, because there was this ugliness that did happen, because people were terrified that Russians would take over through some fifth column, that these separatists would beat up our people who are peacefully demonstrating for Ukrainian unity in places like Donetsk, and that people would be kidnapped and tortured. And that happened in places like the Donbass region in April 2014. It was horrible.
If you were to continue the story up till the modern day, other than calling out the invasion as a bad thing, which you do in this book, but other than that, is there any major change to the story that a reader should expect, or do you feel like following the story as far as you do in this book, it basically tells you where Ukraine is headed? Or do you feel that things that have happened since then, other than besides the invasion, of course, but the invasion's already technically underway, you know, in the events that you lay out in this book, does Ukraine's national story change? I mean, like, has the war, I guess one of the ideas I had reading this was this is an enormous tragedy, but the fact that the war is now happening means that, for better or worse, what's left of Ukraine is this sort of purified, Euromaidanified Ukraine. And a lot of that ambiguity that you're describing in this book, when there was still this possibility for reconciliation, well, now peaceful resolution is over with, obviously, and now it's just a whole world of violence. But there are at least clear sides now. Or is that not how you view Ukraine today?
Well, to be honest, I mean, it was going to be too hard because of reasons of scale, trying to talk about everything up until 2022. The book is basically half the size it was supposed to be. And already it's lengthy enough for Bloomsbury Academic. And that's fine with me. And there was a point where I had to cut this off. But I do sense that the lines are pretty clear. And the great tragedy is that these lands that were sort of in between Russia and Ukraine, they were ambiguous about national identity, and people who were skeptical about the Maidan's mission and so on, and who didn't like what happened in February 2014 in Kyiv. These people are basically being driven off their land. Their communities have been destroyed. And these are now the wastelands of Europe. And that's the greatest tragedy.
They're being driven out of unoccupied Ukraine, you're saying? And then assumedly the pro-Maidan people, to whatever degree they exist, they lived in the Donbass, have also been driven out. I mean, presumably there are still Ukrainians living under the regime they'd rather not have. But you're saying that
is true.
Most of them have been sort of forced to one side or the other by now.
Yeah, I mean, there's been no real choice. I know there are people like Volodymyr Yushchenko who see that perhaps there is still this other force, this other force that could offer an alternative. But I just don't see it in a time like this where everything's at stake. I don't see an alternative to fighting this war to the end, because what is the alternative now? What is it? Russian occupation, and what does that mean? It means retribution against anybody who opposed Russia. And a lot of people will be victims of such an occupation, should it extend beyond the Donbass and the south of Ukraine where it is now.
Right.
Where the lines are now.
Thanks for listening, folks. That's this week's show. As always, check out Mendoza's homepage for our reporting on Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. Share this podcast with your friends and enemies if you want. Write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Until next time.